You're listening to The Way Home with Daniel Darling, a proud member of the Denham Audio Network.
Well, hello and welcome again to The Way Home podcast, my friends. This is Dan Darling, your host. I'm so glad to be with you today. We have a great, great and fun conversation in store for us. I want to thank all of you who listen and all of you who tell people about the podcast, whether you share it on social or you tell a friend. If you regularly listen but are not subscribed via iTunes or Google Play or whatever, I encourage you to subscribe. That just allows that to download automatically to your device when you get it, or Spotify or wherever you get podcasts. And if you enjoy it, would you write a review for me on one of these platforms? If you do write a review, would you be interested in sending that to me through my website, danieldarling.com, through the contact page? If you do that, I would love to send you a free autographed copy of my new book, Away With Words, which is available everywhere books are sold. Okay, today we have a great guest. His name is John Thompson. John is a self-described music lifer. He's the associate dean at the Trevecca School of Music here in Nashville. He's the founder of True Tunes, the podcast and sort of music thing. He's a speaker, producer, author, artist. The best way to describe John is he is sort of a expert on all things CCM, Christian Contemporary Music. And he was a consultant and someone who was interviewed regularly for this new film out called, it's called the Jesus Music Film. I got a chance to attend a screening of this, and I was blown away how good it was, how fun it was. If you are like me and you grew up in the 90s and you love Christian contemporary music, think Amy Grant, Mike W. Smith, Stephen Curtis Chapman, maybe even before that with the Jesus Movement, or maybe even a little bit after that with sort of like the worship revolution with Chris Tomlin and Passion. Man, this is a film that is for you. It tells really the story of Christian music in the last 50 years. It tells it warts and all. It's very moving. And I want to encourage you to go see it. John and I basically talk and riff about different movements within Christian music, the good, the bad, everything. So you'll want to stay tuned for this fun episode with John Thompson, who is the Dean of the School of Music at Trevecca University. I'm glad to have John Thompson here on the Way Home podcast. John, thanks for joining me today.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
So my friend Dave Schrader, who works for kind of for the K-Love, you know, sort of our EMF parent company, you know, and is working on this movie, the Jesus Music movie, had been talking to me about the movie, invited me to a screening a couple weeks ago. And I was like, yeah, I'll go. I think so. And that day I was kind of like, I don't know if I want to go to this. I'd have to get dressed up and all that. Man, I was really blown away how great this movie was. And so, you know, first of all, maybe share a little bit about kind of how this project came about and kind of what the heart is behind it.
Well, you know, my role in it was really limited in this case. The guys were making movies, you know, they make movies, that's their job. And then COVID hits and all of a sudden they're limited in what they could do. From what I understand, having been around them now, they were limited in terms of how many people they could have in a space. I think they could have maybe 10 people on a crew, and you just can't make most movies with 10 people on a crew. So they were sitting around saying, well, what can we do, you know, with these limitations? And one thing they could do were documentaries. And so they were just brainstorming. And I think it was Josh Walsh, who's one of their producers, had always liked the idea of sort of the origin story of Christian music. And I don't even think that a lot of them knew what they were getting into when they started to poke that hornet's nest. But it's a really interesting story. And one of the things that they found was a book I wrote over 20 years ago called Raised by Wolves, a book I'm actually currently in the process of updating significantly. And So they had that book and a few other things. And since then I've worked in the industry. I worked at Capital Christian Music Group in publishing. I worked as the associate dean of the School of Music and Worship Arts at Tribeca. I've managed and consulted for artists. But before all that, I worked at the Cornerstone Festival, and I started a company called True Tunes that was a kind of a rock alternative record store and concert venue mm-hmm. up in Chicago. And I've been an artist myself. So they kind of stumbled into me and asked me if I would come do some interviews. And so I just became one of the people that they talked to for the film. I became one of the historians, I guess, you know, and in the process helped them fill in some gaps as they talked to artists. And they realized that so many of the artists were here in Nashville that even though COVID had kind of shut everything down, there was a lot they could still do and take advantage of that forced rest to tell a story that was way long overdue and being explored. And so they took advantage of that opportunity, started interviewing artists. I don't even think they, like I said, they didn't even know what they were getting into. They just talked and talked and talked and then sort of let the story emerge. And at first they thought they were going to be doing a mini series, like something for a Netflix or a Hulu. Later, the opportunity came for this to be a feature film, which meant they had to cut down all of that footage into a under 2 hour long feature story. So when you look at the film, you see all these artists sitting in a chair and you never even hear from them. So you realize there's this mountain of content that still has yet to be seen. And I've been a writer and an editor, and I just try to help however I can. But my role so far has been cheerleader and coach. I've just been trying to help from the sides. But it's a daunting task that they've taken on, and you can never please everyone, but I really do think that they've started it with this film in a pretty strong way. And I'm really, really thrilled to be a part of it as a kid who was so blown away by this music, and my life has been changed by it. It's just a huge honor to be involved.
Yeah. I mean, I had just so many thoughts, and just, for those listening, this is the Jesus Music movie that's out in theaters. It'll be available on streaming, I believe, on Hulu in January. There's also an accompanying book that is really great. It's called the Jesus Movement, written by Marshall Terrell, and kind of walks through the same kind of narrative arc that the movie does. It has some great pictures and images and everything. But there's so many places we could start, John, but I thought that a couple things that really struck me. I love the fact that it started with the Jesus Movement, which is, I mean, you can argue sort of when did the Christian music industry start? Did it start with the Jesus Movement? Is there earlier, you know, are there earlier like roots to the movement of like Fanny Crosby writing hymns and D.L. Moody sort of using them in his crusade or in his, you know, in his events and starting publishing, you know, publishing hymn books and all that. But I felt like the Jesus Movement was a great place to start. And, you know, I'm 43, so I'm a child of the 80s and 90s. And so there was so much in there that was awesome. You know, for me, you know, I remarked to a friend of mine that went with me to the screening. I said, this is a really great film. This is also like those of us in our 40s just getting really nostalgic mm-hmm. about the artists we love and sort of, but a few things struck me. One was the way that the movie covers the Jesus Movement and how music was central to that movement in a way that I hadn't really thought about, John. So that was one observation that was really, really great for me to see. My dad was essentially, he became a Christian in the Jesus Movement. He came to, went to a Billy Graham crusade in 1971 and they came to Chicago, but he was kind of for a while, he would describe himself as a Jesus freak, you know? So I have a lot of appreciation for it. But the other observation was how at key points along the way, sort of elder statesmen of evangelicalism gave approval to movements that were considered a little bit risque. Like you guys, the movie really covers so well how the music of the Jesus Movement was kind of, you know, is a little bit scary for established evangelical churches.
Yeah, right.
And these guys were threatening, sort of.
Lightly. Yeah.
It was a little scary. I mean, it was like, what is this? And we can't have this. And someone like Chuck Smith opening his doors and saying, no, God is at work here. And Billy Graham at the 72 Expo saying, no, I know all you have these fears. I see God at work in this movement. I see God doing something and stirring something among young people. Just talk about those moments for a minute and just what that did for the Christian music movement.
Well, there's a lot in what you just said. And I think first you have to, you're right in that nothing happens in a vacuum. So Fanny Crosby and D.L. Moody, as well as, frankly, Sister Rosetta Tharpe and all of, I mean, rock and roll doesn't happen without gospel music. And Sister Rosetta Tharpe was an innovator of not only gospel music, but practically invented rock and roll. And so when we talk about, you know, how white Christians were saying that rock and roll was the devil's music, and there's a lot of racism embedded in that because they were calling it race music. You know, I mean, there's just a whole lot of racism embedded in a lot of white Christians' resistance to rock and roll. So there's a whole lot we could dive into with that. But the fact is that Sister Rosetta Tharpe and a lot of black gospel music, if you wanted to roll the tape backwards from the Jesus movement, you're going to find Southern gospel, white Southern gospel, Appalachian gospel, you're going to find hymns, you're going to find it, because nothing just starts out of nowhere. It's all got a backstory. But when you do look at the Jesus movement, you are looking at the kids, the baby boomers, the kids of the people who came back from World War II. You're looking at the kids who grew up in suburbia with, you know, their parents, the greatest generation had come back and they were building suburbia. They were building industrial America. They were fighting this war in Vietnam to fight communism. And these kids were coming up saying, I don't know. I this doesn't make sense. We've put all of our faith in commerce, in money, in industry, in violence. And they're questioning all of that stuff. All of those systems seem to be coming apart at the seams. Like Glenn Kaiser says in the film, the American dream was becoming the American nightmare. And a lot of that, I would call it, frankly, idolatry. When we have a confluence of Christianity with American empire, that was crumbling. And it was the young people that were starting to question that and say, wait a second, no. And now we saw it with the hippies and we saw it with the counterculture. And their answer for a while had been drugs and sex and experimentation of all sorts. And that didn't turn out to have any answers. So then when this new way of understanding Jesus comes along, young people lead the way in that. And it's this film, when you're talking in under 2 hours, you have to choose representative samples to tell your story. You can't just go in and tell the whole story. The fact is, this Jesus movement was happening globally. It didn't start at Calvary Chapel in Southern California by any stretch of the imagination. It was happening simultaneously in England, in New York, and up in the Pacific Northwest, in Chicago, in Florida. There was spontaneous brush fires going on all over the place. And many people really believe that this was a move of the Holy Spirit happening globally to wake up a young generation to kind of grab the reins of the church away from, frankly, the elders who had steered it into the ditch. And now there's always, well, not always, but the beautiful thing is that there are certain elements of that institutional church that go with it, that say, wait a second, okay, maybe this is okay. Maybe there's something these young people are doing here that we need to listen to. But even that becomes complicated because as wonderful, and I wrote an article about this at True Tunes, that as wonderful as it is that we see Billy Graham endorsing this consistently, there's also a lesson to be found in his longer trajectory because he embraces it, he welcomes it in, but early on, his embrace of it is also complicated because at Expo 72, we now know because of the Nixon tapes that come out that during the same week of Expo 72, that's also when Nixon's guys are breaking into the Watergate Hotel. And we know that that Billy Graham had a political agenda going on and he had some anti-Semitism and it gets complicated. But if we take a higher view, we see an arc of growth and wisdom in Billy Graham, that he detached himself from politics. He detached himself from some of that partisanship and he became this nonpartisan source of spiritual guidance to people of all parties. And he became the Billy Graham that could become sort of a chaplain to everybody, that and beloved and massively influential. And I think there's a lesson in there for us as well. So when you think about music and the role that music played in all this stuff, think about the role music was playing in culture in general. It had to mm-hmm. play a role in this revival, because those kids, those baby boomers, were the ones that grew up on Elvis and then the Beatles and then the Rolling Stones. And so it's obvious that Jesus is going to use parables, and he's going to use stories, and he's going to use the language of the day. He's going to use whatever tools at his disposal in first century Palestine to reach the people he's talking to. Why wouldn't he use the tools at his disposal to reach that generation, which is going to include folk music and rock music and soul music and all that kind of stuff? And so it just makes perfect sense that it's going to have to involve music, because music was the language of the culture at that point in time, much, much more even so than it is today, I think.
Yeah, that's such a great word. I guess what I'm looking back and I'm saying, a lesson I've drawn from it is, you know, to have a disposition as a leader, whether it's Billy Graham at certain points, whether it's Billy Graham later when he recognizes, like when he has Toby Mac on the stage and his crew, and recognizes them and says, no, like, this Christian rap is actually a good thing. Everyone's against it. This is a good thing. To kind of have that almost Barnabas-like approach to say, no, I know y'all are suspect of this, but God is at work here. And I feel like a little bit you've seen Bill Gaither serve a role like that in many ways throughout the years, to say, you know, I'm going to platform these people, these emerging artists. I think in some ways you could argue Keith Getty's doing a little bit of that as well. I mean, he's obviously in the hymns genre, but if you look at what he's doing with Sing, that he has, you know, he has Tomlin, he has Travis Cottrell, he has so like this wide group of folks, and him to say, like, no, that, you know, there's a way to have unity here, but kind of platform whoever's emerging and give voice to that. I thought that was really, really a great piece of this. The other thing that I was thinking about when I was watching this movie, as you've talked about how Billy Graham's kind of career arc, and he matured and grew, but it seems like the Christian music industry has had its own arcs too, right? So you start with the Jesus movement, you get into the sort of 70s and 80s, and you're into like Michael W. Smith and Amy Grant, who I love, by the way. And this was like, as a child of the 80s and 90s, just watching this was like awesome for me. Which it's funny because my kids think like Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith is like old people music, because it's right. My, you know, music. Oh, yeah. But to see the music, the Christian music industry mature, or not, I don't even know if it's mature. I'm sorry. Like just change and morph, and, you know, you have evolved Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith, and then you sort of get into the early 2000s, and then you sort of have the turn toward worship music. So just talk a little bit about some of the moves that the Christian music has made in the last 50 years.
Gosh, well, and that's another thing, is this film is really just the tip of the iceberg, because it kind of, it starts with its end in mind. Like, you got to know that this is going backwards with the understanding that it's about the roots of CCM as we understand CCM today. But all the way back through that line, there are all these off-ramps of different cousins from the family tree that said, you know what, I'm going to go this way.
Yeah.
And so, yes, if you keep that Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith, Toby Mac line going, then we end up with the kind of main highway of CCM. My whole career and ministry has been to widen that out, really kind of for a couple of main reasons. One is, it's great that the people that have kind of been fans of that main highway, that's awesome. And it's kind of easy to find those stories. Everybody knows about Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith, mm-hmm. and Toby Mac and DC Talk. And this story does a good job of going deeper into those stories than what a lot of people know. They'd go past the surface, past the pretty stuff, and into the grit. And so that I think is really important, because you don't get to grace. You don't get to grace until you get through the grit. Now, the other thing though, is if you go all the way back into the 70s, not every Christian who was an artist decided to make what we think of as Christian music. Many decided to continue to make music in the general market. People like T-Bone Burnett or Bob Dylan or
Bono
and the guys in U2, BJ Thomas. There's a lot of artists who were like, you know what? I'm a Christian and I want to imbue my music with my faith, but I really feel called to make music for everybody. And that became controversial, especially in the 80s. And I think that was because certain institutional people saw Christian music and Christian subculture, Christian publishing, Christian books, Christian bookstores, not so much as the way the Jesus people had, which was let's resource Christians to go reach the world. It was more like resourcing a culture war. Well, we're going to put a wall up and say there's Christians on this side and there's the world on this side. And anytime we did anything that was about reaching the world, we got arrows in our back. And I know this personally because my whole True Tunes thing was about trying to reach everybody with this stuff. And T-Bone Burnett said something in the press when I was about 12 that had a big influence on me. And he was really paraphrasing C.S. Lewis when he said, as a Christian songwriter, I can either write songs about the light or I can write about what I see by the light. And Lewis had said something very similar in Mere Christianity. And that's pretty obvious, I think. But Christian music evolved in the 80s to be more specifically for people about the light. It was like, let's make songs strictly about God. Let's do this very vertical thing. And then let's write propositional music that kind of says, this is what you should think about God. Whereas other artists were saying, you know what? I want to write about what I see because of the light. And that's going to apply to justice and love and my neighbors and, you know, the hungry and, you know, even the sunset or beauty or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so there's this split. And in the 80s, you can see a lot of Christians who are artists trying to reach out. And in the 90s, when Christian music and the industry got even more successful, you can see the seeds of that starting to take root so that by the end of the 90s, it was actually some of those fringe artists like Sixpence None the Richer and Switchfoot and POD and bands like that that actually cross back over into the mainstream and have massive success, not by doing what we think of as straight down the middle Christian music, but by doing great music, which C.S. Lewis would say, with their Christianity intact. Like, it's in there, but it's not for specifically just for Christians. So that's kind of how this path evolves. And you've got one path that's really music for Christians, by Christians, and that becomes the Christian industry. Then you've got this other path, which is people of faith making music for anybody. And then you've got those who try to end up on one path and try to jump to the other path. And that's where some of the tension emerged in the 90s and in the 2000s. Then when the industry kind of collapsed over the last 15 years, 20 years. Now with streaming and everything like that, you've got people like Lauren Daigle, and who knows what that is. Like, everybody knows she's a Christian, but she can just kind of make music. And in the film, they kind of deal with that at the end, that it's great. Lecrae and artists like that can just sort of be, and there's not that hard wall anymore, but there still is that temptation to succumb to that culture war mentality. Is it a Christian artist or is it an artist making Christian work? And what is that? And that's going to be worth exploring in future conversations for sure.
Hello, friends. I just want to tell you about a really new partnership that we have developed with an amazing company called Canopy. Now, I don't know about you, but as a parent, I find it increasingly difficult to monitor my children's internet consumption with all the devices and computers. And how do you balance safety on the internet in terms of objectionable content, pornography, and things that we don't want them to see, with speed and use of the internet for things that they need, like their homework, getting a hold of them? My oldest one is driving, and I want to be able to her to have a way to get a hold of me. How do you do that? Well, sometimes it feels like you have to prioritize either speed and accuracy and accessibility or safety. Well, my friends at Canopy have developed this really neat tool that they beta tested in Israel, and it's so good they brought it over to the United States. And it uses this proprietary technology using artificial intelligence to block objectionable images, but not always necessarily websites. And so how this works is that even on their phones, if someone texts them something objectionable or they're going to a website that they need to go to but there's objectionable images, it doesn't block the website, but it'll block the images from coming through. And it works in multiple apps that are on their phone in ways that a lot of other filters don't. It's a great, great tool. And if you are a Way Home listener, you can go to canopy.us/wayhome. That's canopy.us/wayhome. canopy.us/wayhome. And you can get a special discount. Your first 30 days free and 20% off of Canopy for life. So you want to do that. Go to canopy.us/wayhome and check this out. It's a great tool that I know you will use and be thankful for as a parent. If you plot the timeline, if you will, of the Christian music industry, Jesus movement into the 80s and 90s with a kind of like Christian music, you know, like, as you said, with those walls of like, that it has to be Christian. And I think you could actually map the kind of church worship wars in that season too. Mm-hmm. But now I feel like it's taken almost a turn back. And Michael W. Smith talked about this, like some of these artists that really did want to do crossover stuff and were proud of it are saying, we want to do more worship stuff. So like right. The turn back to worship, and it seems now, and correct me if I'm wrong, you have artists going the other way. So like it was scandalous, right, for an Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith, or whoever to be popular in the quote world. You know, I'm using that with scare quotes, you know, to have crossover music. But now what you see, I almost see the opposite thing happening where you have country artists, pop artists doing albums of hymns and worship mm-hmm. albums. So it's almost crossed back over to say, yeah, I've had a career doing this, but I want people to know that I'm a Christian and I want to offer something for the church as well. So maybe talk about that phenomenon the last 15, 20 years where worship music has actually become such a big genre. I mean, I know the film talked about how Chris Tomlin is listened to by more people than anybody.
Yeah. Well, I think there's probably two different things that you're talking about there. One is worship music is huge because as more and more churches, especially, you know, evangelical churches, you know, your Southern Baptist churches and your evangelical free churches, as they adopted modern worship as their main worship diet, these modern worship songs proliferated and they're just hugely popular. So yes, more people know those songs than know the artists and the songwriters that wrote those songs. And that's just for sure. So the 200 million plus people sing those songs every Sunday. And that's a massive number. Now it would make sense that some country artists or whatever would say, hey, you know what? It would make sense for us to record some of those songs and sell them at Cracker Barrel. And that is sometimes it's a sincere urge for them. They love those music. They love those songs. They sing them at church and that's very important to them. When Carrie Underwood says, I'm going to do a hymns record because this music is important to me. She doesn't need to do a hymns record. You know, that's something that when she sings something, that's because she wants to sing it. I'm not questioning the sincerity of any of those people. And then other times it's because somebody in the industry sees an opportunity because when folks are in a certain market, they might be open to buying a hymns project and that's fine. Now there's another side of that, which is that the whole world is actually much more interested in sacred music than Christian music people have thought. We've often been told that you can't talk about God, you can't talk about Jesus. That's part of what I mean when I get to the culture war language. We think that we're a persecuted class or that Jesus can't be talked about or whatever. But I just did a feature on the True Tunes podcast that was all about Jesus music that was happening in the 60s all the way through the 80s and 90s up to today. Sufjan Stevens is an artist that everybody mm-hmm. knows is a Christian artist. And he's an indie artist who's got mad respect from all corners of the world. And he's never done Christian music for a Christian label. He's a widely respected artist. Natalie Bergman is an artist on Third Man Records. Jack White from the White Stripes, his label, signed her to do a flat-out Jesus music record called Mercy. It's a phenomenal record. It's to my ears, it's the album of the year. It's a roots rock, roots gospel, Jesus music record that sounds like it could have come out in 1970. She has no awareness of CCM music. She did not grow up with that stuff. She just had a personal experience. She comes from the mainstream. And everybody in the press is adoring that record. And it's a very sincere, true record. I think that there is a sincere hunger for people to tell their personal stories with authenticity. And that's gospel music. And that's why gospel music is respected and loved by people as an actual genre. Whereas CCM music evolved when it jumped over the fence and became music for Christians by Christians. And it kind of evolved in a little bit of a greenhouse on its own. It was a successful greenhouse and it was profitable, and it actually meant and means a lot to a lot of people. So I don't take anything away from that. Niches are great for that, but it kind of developed its own lingo. It appealed to people of a certain subculture, and it lost its ability sometimes to actually speak to the wider culture. There was this old cliche when I was a kid that people said, you know, we're so busy saying Jesus is the answer that we stopped listening to the questions. And gospel music is much more connected to the questions and connected to need and connected to brokenness sometimes than some Christian music. And every so often, a Christian, when I say Christian, I'm talking generally speaking white music, you know, like CCM songs. Sometimes a song like I Can Only Imagine or Butterfly Kisses or an Amy Grant song catches the wind because the general market hears it and their questions are being answered in some way. They're finding resonance with that song. And so sometimes those are worshipful songs. Sometimes those are thoughtful, personal songs. But the fact is, people are listening to music for spiritual reasons more than ever before. And right now, with our culture the way it is, with the disharmony and the fractured nature of our society and everything that's going on, disease and war, man, music should be doing exactly what it did in the Jesus movement 50 years ago. And I think that there's a wide open opportunity for it, but we need to be thinking about it as gospel music, as Jesus music. And I think that there's a lot more openness to that than there is to propositional kind of code speak music that's designed by Christians for Christians on this side of the wall. We need to be thinking, well, why is it that some of this stuff like Kirk Franklin and Natalie Bergman and stuff will work, or Sufjan Stevens will work over here? And there's an answer somewhere in there. I'm not saying it's a simple answer. No simple answers are good answers, but there is an answer, and that's what we're trying to figure out, I think.
Yeah, that's a fascinating observation. I do feel like one of the things they talked about in the movie was that the time we're in right now has some similarities with the kind of period out of which the Jesus movement came. Doesn't totally map over onto that because we have different conditions right now, but it seemed very similar. So I've got you for a few more minutes, and I have two questions. One is, I would say, what do you make then of the explosion in the last, I would say, decade, the kind of renaissance in hymn writing? You know, when I map onto this sort of trajectory that the Jesus movement movie makes, and the last part of the film talks about kind of a turn again toward worship music as churches open up to modern worship, right? I think that's not a coincidence. Churches say, oh, you know, actually the worship wars are over, drums are fine, modern worship's okay, which then leads to an explosion in worship music. But then you also have a reaction a little bit to worship music and saying, hey, can we get some of those old hymns back? So then you have this explosion in hymn writing. So what do you make of that movement is one question.
Well, I think it's just a counterbalance. It's that a lot of the modern worship stuff is very personal. It's very therapeutic. It's very much about me and my emotions. And it's not anchored to propositional stuff, to theological stuff, mm-hmm. to scriptural stuff. And so this modern hymn thing, Sandra McCracken is one of my absolute favorite writers, and she's able to balance that out and come up with something that is singable. So the melodies, it's kind of finding a happy medium between something that's singable, that's not got too many lyrics and all that stuff, but it's also still got something that's scripturally sound and it's appropriate for church. And it's just kind of the pendulum maybe swung so far over to this way that the uh-huh. modern hymns thing is pulling it back for some churches this way. And it's kind of trying to find a happy medium. I think it's really all it is kind of a correction of that for some churches. And I personally find it really, really refreshing.
Yeah, me too. And yet in some way, the kind of retro nature of hymns in some ways is a unifying factor, because across genres, across races and classes, people have memory of hymn lyrics, right? So you're seeing not just, you know, reformed guys like me appreciate hymns, you know, like, but you're seeing people record hymns albums across genres, recovering some of these, and it's almost become its own sort of genre in and of itself, which I think is fascinating to kind of track that.
I did a thing you might be interested in on YouTube when I was at Tribeca with Kevin Twitt and Sandra McCracken. It's a two-part series where we talked about the difference between hymns and modern worship songs and how to write a hymn and how to use a hymn. And it was just kind of a workshop thing, but there's definitely an opportunity for in there. And there, I don't think that there's a lot of tension, but there is a difference. And like with anything, there differences require some mindfulness and some attention. And some people are overly enamored with hymns just because they think they're fancy and they're complicated and they're erudite and everything. And other people are very anti-worship songs because of the opposite. And then there's the reverse reaction. And I think there's probably a room for balance between the two. Some people hold those hymns, those old hymns up on a pedestal and think that those guys were perfect that wrote them and that the modern worship writers are a bunch of slugs. And then you start looking into the lifestyles of those hymn writers and you realize, they're just a bunch of old-time rock and roll losers too, you know. So
yeah, and I'd so appreciate that because you know, I'm someone who says I love hymns, I love hearing, and because the lyrics bring me back to my childhood because I grew up sort of more fundamentalist, and so that's all we sang. But yet I will turn on K-Love and appreciate worship music, and you know, the idea that you have to sort of choose is something I'm not comfortable with. I find myself loving my 80s and 90s CCM. I find myself just loving the Sandra McCracken, Andrew Peterson sort of stuff. But I also like some of the modern artists and the hymn stuff. It does seem, I guess that's my last question. It does seem like this is a good time for songwriting and for creativity in the church. Do you feel that way, that this is almost a golden era in terms of creativity and the different genres and niches of Christian music? And it seems like there's less conflict between the genres. There's less worship wars, or maybe I'm just not seeing them.
Well, it could be. I think that it's a great time in that the walls for distribution are down. There's no walls anymore. So there's no cost. There's no barrier to entry. I could go write a song right now, and by dinner time, I could have a recording up and distributed to the whole planet. The problem is everybody else can too. And so there's a lot of chaos, and we're all exhausted with the amount of information that's coming at us. So how do we find the good stuff? And we're lacking, a lot of us, trusted voices to help us find great new music to listen to. So it can be difficult for the next generation of writers to find a way to make that. You have to spend a lot of time doing something to become excellent at it. You've got to spend thousands of hours, many years invested in that to go from good to great and great to transcendent. And it's going to be hard over the next 10 years to find those transcendent writers who are going to be the next generation Keith Gettys, you know, and whatever that's going to have to sound like, because it can't sound like what 60-year-old white people like today. If they like Keith Gettys kind of music today, that's not going to work in 10 years, because it needs to be what young people today are going to like, you know. And my concern is that it's hard to make a living doing that. And so we need some trusted voices to gather enough attention to draw enough of an audience so that as people are streaming this music, they can find Patreon backers, they can find Kickstarter supporters, and they can patch together a living so that they can invest 10 years in that kind of writing and hobble together a living. It's not like anybody's getting rich off of that stuff. Very, very, very few. But that's what we're trying to do with True Tunes, is just find that audience again, like what we had 20 years ago. Find those people to pay attention to that conversation, because there are so many talented young writers, but they just cannot cut through that noise. So yes, it's great in that it's available. It's a disadvantage in that it's hard to get people to pay attention, because they tend to just go back to the one or two or three or four people that they already know they love, because they're overwhelmed with the other options. And we have the brands. And so if you're on the modern worship side, you go with the Bethels or the Hillsongs or whatever brands you already like. And if you're on the hymn side, you go, whatever Keith tells you is cool, you just go to him, and he's your tastemaker there. What about in the middle? And what about the other stuff that can't get into Keith's thing and can't get into the other thing? And then what about the stuff that's not going to be necessarily in the church, but you want to listen to when you're jogging or running or driving, but it's going to be those thoughtful artists, the next version of U2, the next version of Sufjan Stevens, the next version of Coldplay or Bruce Springsteen or Michael Card. Like, where are those things going to come from if there's so much haystack that we can't find the needles? And so that's kind of the challenge of the next era, I think, for Christians making art.
That's a great word. Well, John Thompson, thanks for joining me today on the Way Home podcast. I want to encourage everybody to go see this movie, the Jesus Music movie. It's in theaters right now, and John is featured prominently, really helping tell the history in a great way of the Christian music world and industry. And then there's a great book that goes along with it. We'll have links to all this in our show notes. But John, thanks for joining me today. This was fun.
Absolutely, man. It's been an honor.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Way Home podcast with Daniel Darling. For more information, you can visit danieldarling.com. If you do like this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast catcher. We also encourage you to rate and review so others can know about the podcast. You can follow me at Dan Darling on Twitter or go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/Daniel M. Darling. I also want to encourage you again to check out my latest book, Away With Words, and you can visit awaywithwordsbook.com. Thank you for listening again to the Way Home podcast.
This podcast is part of the Edify Podcast Network. Edify is a faith-inspiring app that brings together thousands of the best Christian podcasts in one place for your listening enjoyment. Cut through the noise and grow your faith by diving into the world's top Christian podcasts today. Download the Edify app for free from the App Store or Google Play, or by going to edify.app. That's E-D-I-F-I.app.